Israel, which was really only for Jews in the first place.
And Professor, I'm wondering if you mentioned previously the acquiescence or the refusal to confront the problem in general in Israeli society of the occupation. Why do you think that is, especially given the fact that Israel in its early years had a very vibrant labor, socialist, and humanitarian movement among those who created the State of Israel? What has happened?
Well, I would say, I mean, the simple answer is that power corrupts, and that Israel has suffered for years from a kind of euphoria of power. And when I talked about the sort of link between what happened in 1973 and what happened in 2023, it is exactly that. That is that Israel came to believe that it's strong enough to be able to do what it likes, and it does not need to have any political compromise, which means territorial compromise. The war of 1973 could have been avoided had Israel agreed to negotiate with Anwar Sadat at the time, the president of Egypt, which it did eventually after the war, and returned the Sinai Peninsula and received peace in return. But 3,000 Israeli soldiers were killed, some of whom were my classmates. And the same happened now. That is, Israel refused to talk about any territorial compromise and believed that Hamas can lob a few rockets here and there, but by and large, it's not a problem for it. And therefore, there's no need to think of any territorial compromise. And this became the sense in the large sectors of the Israeli public. People could live in Tel Aviv, have a good time, have a good life, and 20 miles to the east, there was an apartheid regime, but it really had very little to do with them. And the curious thing was, and this is what we were trying to point out in August, was that the people who were protesting, the hundreds of thousands of Israelis who quite remarkably went out to the streets every Saturday to protest against the erosion of democracy in Israel, refused to talk about the occupation. And when I was there protesting against that, we were marginalized. We were pushed to the side, and people said, well, occupation, that's a difficult term. You know, not everybody agrees on that. Let's not talk about it now. It'll divert attention. Whereas, in fact, it was the core of the very attempt to change the rules of the game in Israel.
In a moment, we'll return to our interview with Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. The Israeli-American scholar has been described by the U.S. Holocaust Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. Back in 20 seconds. Nasak by Clarissa Nabil Bitar, lyrics by the Palestinian poet Mohammed El-Kurd. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We return to Omer Bartov, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. The Israeli-American scholar has been described by the U.S. Holocaust Museum as one of the world's leading specialists on genocide. He spoke to us on Wednesday, one day after the House voted to censure Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress, for her criticism of Israel. Professor Bartov, you are a professor at Brown University in Providence. You're in Cambridge right now. And I wanted to ask you about the dissent on college campuses and how they're being dealt with. In Cambridge, at Harvard, you know about the students who were protesting on behalf of Palestinian rights. A truck carries around their faces, and above their faces it says anti-Semite. And on television, you'll see pieces on anti-Semitism, which is very real in the world. For example, the burning of the Austrian cemetery in Vienna. and many other situations, but they will be blended together. This is on the mainstream networks with images of people protesting, holding a Palestinian flag. Can you talk about what's happening on college campuses and people fearing that their concern for justice is being translated as anti-Semitism and cause for them to be blacklisted?
So, look, this is a very complex issue. I agree. I think part of it is, frankly, ignorance about the reality on the ground in Israel-Palestine. And that has to do, obviously, not with your show, but with much of how the mainstream media in the United States is presenting things. But also, young people, students can find other sources of information to better know what is happening on the ground. So generally, I think there's a little bit of issue of information. Anti-Semitism is real, as you say, and has been growing, and is a not just lamentable, but frightening phenomenon. And I obviously have no sympathy with it. But there is, and there has been for a long time, a tendency to label any criticism of the state of Israel, any criticism of the policies of any particular government, let alone criticism of Israel as a state, as such, as anti-Semitism. And that is a policy of the right wing in Israel, and that's a policy of the right wing in this country, and it has nothing to do with the truth. One can be a Zionist or a non-Zionist or an anti-Zionist and not be anti-Semitic. One can be and against Zionist, but against particular Israeli policies. I very strongly support the existence of the state of Israel, and I'm highly critical of its policies. And some people would call me a self-hating Jew. But that is nonsense. That has to do with criticism of policies that not only function as oppression of Palestinians over a very long period of time, 56 years of occupation of Palestinians, a refusal by the Israeli government to ever talk about what happened in 1948. So this kind of shutting up the entire conversation, and at the same time, a belief that Jews, like other nations, have a right of self-determination. So we have to separate the two. I think that at the moment, in the demonstrations, there is a sort of heightening of passions. And in part, it is because of the policies of the Israeli government. I do feel that when people march in support of Palestinian lives, and I'm very much in favor of that, one does also have to remember what happened on October 7th. On October 7th, over 1,000 Jewish civilians, Israeli Jewish civilians, there were actually some Arabs there too, some Bedouin who lived there too, were butchered in the most heinous manner. And this was live streamed. This has been deeply wounding to Israeli society. Almost every person in Israel knows people who were killed there or kidnapped, including myself, members of my own family who were either killed or are now in Gaza. And one has to recall that there are 240 people now held as hostages. And so I think that when one protests the policies of Israel, for the sake of, and this has to do also with what Representative Tlaib said, which I completely agree with. I thought it was a very moving speech, but I think it's important to also stress that other side. There has been a dehumanization of both sides. Occupation dehumanizes people. It dehumanizes the occupier and it dehumanizes the occupied. And the way to deal with this is to talk about the political future. How do we move forward? A ceasefire would be wonderful, and I'm very much in support of it, but it won't put an end to the violence. The end to the violence will come only as a result of a peaceful resolution of this 100-year-old conflict, which has caused so much blood. That is, I think, what we should try to push the American administration to do, to change its policies, to put pressure on the Israeli government to finally relent and to begin again negotiations with the Palestinians.
And let me ask you about the term from the river to the sea, which the Israeli government takes, and those who charge others with anti-Semitism say it means the annihilation of the Jewish population of Israel. I'm looking at the Likud Party platform of March 1977, the right of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, which is the land of Israel. And it says the right of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is eternal and indisputable, and is linked with the right to security and peace. Therefore, Judea and Samaria will not be handed to any foreign administration between the sea and the Jordan. There will only be Israeli sovereignty. That's between the sea and the Jordan River, between the river and the sea. Can you talk about that term?
Yes, you know, the originators of the Likud party, the revisionist part of the Zionism, under the great leader Jabotinsky, had a song that they used to sing, and the song was "The Jordan has two banks. This one belongs to us, and the other one too." That is, they were not only talking actually about so-called historical Palestine, which is mandatory Palestine of the interwar period. They were actually talking also about parts of the Jordan, of what is now the Kingdom of Jordan, as belonging to the future Jewish state. So when we talk about from the Jordan to the sea, we are talking about the territory that is now controlled by Israel. And that territory, there are now 7 million Jews and 7 million Palestinians. 2 million Palestinians were Israeli citizens, 3 million Palestinians were in the West Bank, and 2 to 2.5 million Palestinians, most of the population of Gaza are refugees in Gaza. So it's 7 million versus 7 million. To talk about a Palestinian state or a Jewish state between the Jordan and the sea, the question, of course, arises, so what happened to the, what will happen to the other half? That is really the question. If one talks about a Palestinian state that refuses to recognize the Jewish right of self-determination, that is, of the right of Jews to have a state of their own, the question is, what would happen to the Jews there? Would they go back to Europe, as some people say, whatever that actually means? And if you have a state the way the Israeli right, the Likud party, and now the much more radical, really Jewish supremacist elements in Netanyahu's government, the Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, these people who sort of trace their roots back to Rabbi Kahana, who are really Nazis, if you ask yourself, what do they mean? They want to create a Jewish state that does not have Palestinians in it, no Arabs in it. And the policy has been consistently to make life as unbearable for the Palestinians there so that either they will finally move out, which they have no intention of doing, or to use an emergency situation such as exists right now, under the cover of which they could be ethnically cleansed. And that's a major worry now among Palestinians or Israeli citizens who are worried about a second Nakba, a second expulsion of Palestinians after 1948, something that has been mentioned by a number of Israeli politicians, and of course a major worry in the West Bank and in Gaza. So what we need to think of is not the term from the Jordan to the sea, which is the territory that Israel now controls, but how does that territory get to be shared by these two groups in ways that do not include oppression, lack of any rights, lack of equality, and certainly does not include violence and expulsion?
And finally, Professor Omer Bartov, the issue of a two-state solution or one-state solution, if you could take that on in a nutshell.
Yes. So, you know, I used to be a strong supporter of the two-state solution, and I gradually realized that this was a sort of fig leaf of the Israeli left while the country kept settling the West Bank and making it impossible to create an independent Palestinian state there. And we kept saying, well, but at the end, there will be a two-state solution. So the traditional two-state solution, to my mind, is no longer viable. So what is viable? And I think, and I belong to a group of people who've been talking about it for quite a while, that the only solution is a confederation, which would mean that there would be two states. There would be a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. They both would have full sovereignty, and they would be along more or less the borders of 1967, the Green Line, so-called. But they would make a distinction between residency and citizenship so that people, say Jews, who live in a Palestinian state could remain Israeli citizens who have rights of residency in a Palestinian state, but have to then adhere to all the laws, rules, and regulations of that Palestinian state. And Palestinians who live, say, in Nablus and would like to live in Haifa, like a Frenchman from Paris who would like to live in Berlin, could move to Haifa, and they could have rights of residency, but they'd have to conform to all the rules and regulations of the Israeli state, but they would vote for to a Palestinian parliament. And Jerusalem would be the joint capital of both. And above that, there would be institutions that would take care of the mutual affairs of these two states, which are very tightly woven together now by their infrastructure, electricity, water, and so forth. It's really impossible to cut them apart. That is right now, of course, sounds like a pipe dream, but I think that in the long run, that is probably the only viable solution. And I'll add one last thing to that, which is very important both to Jews and Palestinians, which is that both states would have the right of return. The Jews could say, as they say now, that Jews who want to become Israeli citizens wherever they live can come. And Palestinians in the Palestinian state could say all Palestinian refugees who would like to come back to Palestine could come and become Palestinian citizens, and under certain rules could also move to the Israeli part of so-called mandatory Palestine as residents.
And why not simply a one-state solution?
I think a one-state solution is something that neither one side nor the other wants, because the Palestinians quite rightly want the right of self-determination, want to have their own state, as do the Jews. And both sides are afraid that the other side would be more powerful. Obviously, right now, under current conditions, the state of Israel is much more powerful militarily, economically, than the Palestinian part of the land. And so in that sense, a one-state solution would actually perpetuate Jewish supremacy in the whole country.
Omer Bartov is professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. The Israeli-American scholar is one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. He recently signed an open letter warning of Israel committing a potential genocide in Gaza. Coming up, three Palestinian groups have petitioned the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel for committing genocide and apartheid. Back in 30 seconds.
أنا وأنت أوه أنت وأنا أوه في ليلك عتم حيرة وضوا صدى أصوات وفوضى أقضى في أعماقك نور ونا حزنك حبك وجع وداع
by Marwan Halabi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Three Palestinian human rights groups have filed a lawsuit with the International Criminal Court calling on the ICC to issue arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other leaders for genocide, incitement to genocide, and the crime of apartheid. The three groups, Al-Haq, Amizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, told the court that Israel's suffocating siege of Gaza and the indiscriminate attacks on densely populated civilian areas amount to war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The lawsuit also seeks the arrest of Israeli President Isaac Herzog and the Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. This comes as the death toll in Gaza is nearing 11,000. According to Palestinian health officials. We're joined now by Palestinian human rights attorney Noura Erekat, associate professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, part of the Palestinian team of academics, intellectuals, and activists who helped bring the ICC lawsuit. She's joining us from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Noura. If you can explain what this lawsuit is all about.
Absolutely. This lawsuit comes as a collective effort on behalf of the three organizations you mentioned, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, who are on the ground and documenting the ongoing atrocities. It's one of a myriad of efforts that have been filed before the International Criminal Court. For example, very recently, Reporters Without Borders have also submitted a petition calling on the ICC to investigate the now killing of 34 journalists, several of them while they were working during this onslaught. The one thing that we want to highlight as the ad hoc team is that this is not merely a lawsuit against Israeli individuals as stipulated by the petition, which it very much is, but it is also holding on trial the International Criminal Court, the international criminal law, international legal institutions as a whole, which have demonstrated an absolute double standard when it comes to the Global South. We've seen this in the tenure of the ICC, which since its establishment has opened over two dozen cases, all of them on the African continent. All those who have been indicted, with the exception of Slobodan Milosevic, have been Arab and African individuals, heads of states, officials. And so here we are pushing the ICC to either hold Israel to account in what is an ongoing genocide, where the leaders of it have told us very much that they have the specific intent to destroy a Palestinian people in whole or in part, and demonstrated the specific underlying acts in order to effectuate it, or demonstrate for us that this is actually a moment where the ICC demonstrates that it's not effectuate, that it's not effective, that it is actually part of punishing a global South and letting Western countries move forward with impunity.
We spoke to Razi Sarani, the world-renowned human rights attorney in Gaza City, and the heartbreaking plea from Razi, who remained in northern Gaza after his house was bombed. He particularly held Karim Khan, the lead prosecutor of the ICC, called him out, saying, when Russia attacked the children of Ukraine, the ICC immediately opened war crimes investigations, and then raised the issue of where is he on Israel and Palestine. If you can address this and also talk about an ICC case that has already been opened, an official investigation into possible war crimes committed by Israel in the West Bank back in 2021, in West Bank, in Gaza, and East Jerusalem.
Raji is absolutely right. Karim Khan, the prosecutor of the ICC, opened the investigation within a week of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin for the forcible transfer of Ukrainian children to Russia immediately, without question. In this case, it took the prosecutor, Karim Khan, 3 weeks to travel to Rafah in order to investigate what was in the first week an evident example of genocidal intent, mass killings, the destruction of those conditions of life that would reduce the ability of Palestinians to survive. In this situation, what we see is not merely a repetition of history, but a continuation of colonial legacies, and one that led to the failure of the League of Nations, frankly, in the aftermath of Italy's invasion of Ethiopia in 1935, where a fascist Italy led by Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. And in that moment, Ethiopia, which was a member state of the League of Nations, and rather than hold Italy to account, which was dropping indiscriminate chemical weapons on the Ethiopian people, instead, the Red Cross decried the Ethiopians as being too savage to follow the laws of war. Media were running headlines that Ethiopians were hiding and sheltering in hospital, using them as human shields. And world powers failed to impose sufficient sanctions on Italy in this moment. And this demonstrated the limits of these international institutions and led to the failure of the League of Nations. We are in a similar moment right now. These international institutions need to act. And instead, we're seeing a stalemate, and we're seeing international leaders led by the United States, as well as the UK, as well as France, who are basically providing a green light to Israel to commit genocide, to commit these atrocities. This is not out of nowhere. Everything started before October 7th. And Israel, this is a moment where Israel has not been held to account. It is a systematic failure to hold Israel to account for decades. International organizations have said that Israel is practicing the crime against humanity of apartheid. There was a near consensus between 2020 and 2021. And yet, rather than impose sanctions in that moment, rather than mobilize international mechanisms and institutions in order to dismantle apartheid, we saw the United States celebrate and normalize Israeli apartheid, and we saw them continuing to normalize relations with other Arab regimes. It was this fundamental failure that has led us to this moment and an ongoing crisis of a lack of accountability, of an imposition of two types of law, one for the global north, one for the global south. This is a hypocrisy on the part of Western governments and demonstrates that there is no such thing as Western universalism, but instead continues to be two sets of laws on two sets of people. And what's wonderful, the only thing that provides us hope, is that a mass movement of individuals, peoples, communities have risen up against their governments, also to demonstrate the hypocrisy of Western democracy. Even in the United States, consider that 66% of Americans have demanded a ceasefire. 80% of registered Democrats have demanded a ceasefire. And yet only 19 out of 535 members of Congress have endorsed it. Consider that that same Congress censored the only Palestinian American representative in government at the very moment that she represents the majority. So this is not just a crisis of international legal institutions, but also a crisis of democratic or so-called democratic institutions in the countries in which we live.
And how does the tens of thousands of Palestinians being forced south right now, we just have 20 seconds, fit into your charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity?
What we're seeing is an ongoing Nakba of the Palestinians who are with their hands up and on their feet with white handkerchiefs in order not to be killed. This is an ethnic cleansing of the north of Gaza. It's a continuation of the Nakba to take the Palestinian land without Palestinian people. It is a crime against humanity and fits in a larger framework of genocidal warfare.
Palestinian human rights attorney Noura Arakat, associate professor at Rutgers University, we thank you so much. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at VOL_4_CJSF@SFU.ca. Again, that's VOL_4_CJSF@SFU.ca. Or you can visit our website, CJSF.ca. It's CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1.